In the introduction to your book, Mikhail Gorbachev refers to the global crisis that urgently demands our attention. What were the realizations and motivations, as someone with a scientific approach, that led you to want to write this book in particular?
Well, there are systemic considerations. Basically, this global human nature combined system, complex system, has become unstable because there are too many innovations in it that are no longer controlled by institutions. So it's basically outrunning its own control capabilities. And things are happening that were not planned, like environmental degeneration, like the polarization between rich and poor, even the growth of poverty, the increase, the remaining illiteracy, the epidemics of diseases. In other words, the system has running out of control, basically. And these are the considerations that have led me to think of the global system as an integrated overall system that needs to renew itself.
You've referred to the 21st century being the century of responsibilities. There seems to be a very strong message in this book to wake up and take responsibility.
Well, it's an enormous opportunity today to create something new. You don't create something basically new in a stable system. The deviations are usually shut down. I mean, in the society, people who deviate from the norm are excommunicated, so to speak, or put behind bars, or marginalized at the very least. But in an unstable situation, innovations have a chance to what you call, in a systems chaos theory perspective, to nucleate, to all of a sudden to grow up and to spread within the system. So this is a big responsibility, it's a big opportunity. And being conscious members of this complex system, the only one endowed with this kind of, as human beings, the only one endowed with this kind of reflexive, high-level consciousness, we not only know that we know, but we can also plan ahead and see the consequences, perceive the consequences of our actions, then this is obviously a responsibility to try to move in a direction that is good for us and good for our children.
In the book, you talk about accepting the problems of the planet, getting us to look at our population increase, the spreading poverty, the widening gap between rich and poor, the climate change and the social breakdown. There's a long list of things. And you go into some detail about the choice between breakdown or breakthrough.
Well, it's entirely possible to create a new civilization. Our individual values would permit it. Our institutions are lagging behind, basically. We all know that we want to change, but there are very few real attempts to actually change the system. And those who have a major stake in the status quo are not going to create or want fundamental change, with very few exceptions. And those who are very poor cannot do much, but people who still have a choice and have the motivation, they should need to get together. That means in civil society, we need to get together to create change. So I think it can be done. It's a very exciting times because we have the know-how. We could have the money if you spend a little bit less on armaments and on concentrate wealth a little bit less in people who already have an enormous amount, but will distribute a bit better, not as charity, but as joint enlightened self-interest, have the market operate in a way that it reaches everybody. So level a bit the playing field. Right now it favors the rich and favors the powerful at the expense of the poor and the powerless. So all these things are possible, and the question is the will, to muster the will. And you don't expect the so-called political will anymore from political leadership. With little exceptions, they are not going to come and do this in time. But this famous will has to become a social, a societal will, coming from the grassroots, expressed through NGO movements, for example, expressed through the internet, people joining together and demanding changes. I think then it could happen.
Could you describe the breakdown scenario, the world financial system in peril, increasing violence from terrorism, intercultural conflict. I mean, a lot of that already seems to be happening, which is quite a scary thing. But then you mention in the breakthrough scenario about the analogy of the butterfly flapping its wings, and it can create an air current that can actually be amplified until it changes the weather on the other side of the world, which is a pretty amazing concept.
Well, this is very well documented. We can have, there are simulations, computer simulations of complex systems when they are governed by so-called chaotic attractors, sometimes known as strange attractors. We know that these attractors appear at a given point in the system, what the modelers call it, appearing out of the blue. In other words, there is no previous routes for them. All of a sudden there's a new attractor, there's a new dynamic taking over in the system. And this is when the system is unstable. So we have that situation, and a new chaotic attractor, for example, was Hitler, you know, was a bad one. And in the 20th century, a number of these major ideological revolutions like Lenin and Mao and Hitler and Castro and all these people have actually created were butterflies in the beginning, and they spread very fast because they came at a time when the system was unstable and therefore very could be changed. And this, if you are not conscious of the perils and conscious of the opportunities, then we could create perhaps positive butterflies, the kind of butterflies that where we could foresee a beneficial effect instead of another dictatorship.
What do you think about the grassroots global movements that are happening at the moment, the big demonstrations against war? And what about the feeling that people out there are demonstrating in huge numbers, but they're still not perceivably changing things? They feel very disempowered. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, it is a very, very positive thing, this peace movement. And it should show people that what they can achieve if they want to. It would be very sad if the peace movement would then kind of vanish or diminish just because we think that there's been a declaration that the war in Iraq has been won. As we know, at the present time, as we sit here today, it has not been won. The battles are going on. And I doubt that any war can permanently settle a social crisis. There are other means of doing that, not simply by installing a regime by military force. So the peace movement mustn't disappear, and it must become a permanent endeavor and must be linked worldwide. It can be done. The social forum, you know, during the G8 meetings is already fairly well organized, and it has become much more powerful. Each year it becomes more powerful. There's NGO community, you know. If you think back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were a few thousand NGOs, and they were sort of, as the saying went in America, around the UN, they're little old ladies in tennis shoes, as what they said. Now it's a powerful movement, and they're full-time staffs, and what they need is coordination. Many of them doing the same things, so almost the same things, and they would need to join forces, networking, and until you create a movement that has a really a decisive effect. It can be done.
And the Club of Budapest, which you founded in 1993, it has issued very strong statements against waging war at any cost, and that war is a crime against humanity. Stockpiling weapons is just not tolerable in the hands of any state.
Yeah, I think war as an instrument of national policy has become intolerable for a simple reason, that we no longer have a world that is divided between one nation and another, one nation that is us and the other one's them, so that they can wage legitimate war on others. I think there's a very nice expression which has become quite popular in Germany, which is called the Weltinnenpolitik, the world domestic politics. In a way, if you think that we are all belonging to a global village, and we're all members of it, even if we belong to different nations and different cultures, but we're all members of a larger political and social and ecological unit, then waging war on another group is civil war. And civil war, as we know, is not tolerable. So we should, as human beings in a global village, recognize that simply war is not an instrument for settling conflicts.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Club of Budapest. It's a group of very well-known people It's a powerful message. But these distinguished members are not the ones actually in power, of course. And how can you, as a group, expect to make a real difference in the world?
Well, our members share the basic idea of the club. We have created together this manifesto on planetary consciousness, which states that the evolution of consciousness is the best and maybe the only real hope for a peaceful and sustainable world. They share this view. And then it's up to the club, up to the secretariat of the club, to create events, projects, occasions in which this idea can be brought to people. We're writing reports, we're giving awards to like-minded individuals as well as projects that manifest this kind of new consciousness. It happens every year. And we're organizing surveys of this new culture, what's called the culture of cultural creatives. And worldwide, in 14 different countries, there are local activities bringing together like-minded people. And we want to network with other organizations to bring to attention this factor that we can change the world, we have the power, but we must get together to do so.
You very much talked about upgrading and evolving our consciousness, but do you think it's really possible as human beings when we're so inherently selfish?
Individually, there's no psychological block for enlarging our sphere of loyalties. If we were only selfish, we wouldn't have society at all. We would be living in cannibalistic family tribes, clans perhaps. But the very fact that we created societies in which we work together, whether we realize it or not, I think we have to admit with Aristotle that man is a social animal. The question is, to what extent are we embedded in society? What is the extent of our identification? Classically, first it was the kinship group, then it was a social group or an economic group, then it was a political group. And these political groups have grown throughout history. There was a fallback in the early Middle Ages, then it started growing again. And it reached about 350 years ago the level of the nation state. Now that's our identification. We are members of a given country, we are citizens of our subject of a given country. And so now the question is to enlarge the sphere of our identification beyond the nation state. It can be done in Europe. It's already growing, where in addition to people having a national identity, they also feel somewhat having a European identity. And members who work with NGOs and people who work with the United Nations and other international organizations also develop very clearly a kind of a global identity, global loyalties. And it's remarkable, it can be done. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your national identity, your family identity, or your cultural identity, but embedded in a larger species identity. I think it's humanly entirely possible psychologically. What is required is yet the organizational form in which this can be expressed.
Just wanted to mention rights and ethics, which you mentioned in your book. You say that universal rights have been proclaimed in the 20th century. I mean, it's a significant milestone, but they're not accorded the respect. And isn't it difficult to decide on ethics? I mean, it's quite a subjective thing.
Well, again, what I mean by ethics follows from what I just said about the loyalties. If you are operating within the embrace of a wider community, then what applies to the previously to the smaller community applies also to the wider community. In a smaller community, in a family, in an organization, in a culture, in a city, a community, you expect others to behave toward you as you behave toward them. I mean, this is the famous golden rule. We don't apply this beyond the national or community level. We think we can behave all kinds of ways to people who belong to other nations and to other cultures without expecting that they would then behave the same way toward us. So we just have to enlarge our ethics to have this global dimension, because for better or for worse, we have created a global village. We are interacting globally in the economic and financial and technological sphere. We're interacting in terms of communication and in terms of flows of people over the continent. So that's a reality, and our ethics have to reflect this reality.
Now, the book You Can Change the World, you talk about an holistic approach, getting more involved in the business world and the civic sphere, all of those things. It's meant to be a practical handbook, isn't it? And you even give 10 commandments of sustainable living in there.
Well, it's meant for people who ask, well, all right, if there is something meaningful I can do, what is it precisely that I could do? Of course, there are a great many things one can do, and I couldn't just begin to list them. But a few things, yes, we have suggested what people can do in the private sphere, what they can do in when they enter on the market. They enter on the market every time they go to a supermarket or to a store or purchase anything. Every time when they work as a professional in an organization, and when they vote as citizens, and when they participate in a community, whether as parents or any other capacity. So this is a guide, trying to give people some ideas to illustrate basically the range of things that people can do if they feel that it's their responsibility to do the right thing.
And right at the end of the book, there's a postscript, and you describe how life could be in 2020. It seems to me quite utopian. I mean, the things that you mention are the UN being replaced by the United Peoples Organization, a transnational system of decision-making between states. I mean, will nations relinquish some of their control in favor of increased cooperation, more local democracy happening, even no international debt, and a universal world currency called the Gaia. All of those things, you see that they are achievable.
Well, we say that in the introduction to this little scenario, that a star is there, is important. Its importance is not in reaching a star, but in being there to guide our steps. We know that these things in principle are feasible. There is no real reason, there is no financial, no economic, technological reason why we couldn't do it. The blockages are the inertia associated with the current institutions. On the other hand, this inertia is bound to be broken sooner or later, within a matter of perhaps a decade at the most, because the world, as we know, is not sustainable. So it's exposed to increasing stress. When that reaches a critical level, then all of a sudden things start happening. You know, if you had this discussion, for a similar discussion in the year 1988, for example, and we would have made a scenario saying, well, next year all the Eastern Bloc countries are going to become independent and going to reject the communist ideology and going to have free elections. And a year later, the Soviet Union is going to dissolve, and they're going to forbid the very existence of the Communist Party. It would have been very well taken comment, saying, well, you're talking pure utopia. You know, this is not realistic. These are the butterfly effects. These are the bifurcations that, in a systems science perspective, one knows happen in a complex system. Only one doesn't know exactly when they happen, you know. So we know that sooner or later the system reaches the critical threshold. We don't know exactly when it will happen, and we don't know exactly what will be the catalyst for that. A number of things could happen. But at this point, it's a good idea to keep ourselves open to possibilities. A very bad scenario would actually have a breakdown, with people being completely helpless and not knowing what to do. There could be a period of chaos that could see unparalleled violence, including weapons of mass destruction to nuclear weapons and everything else happening. You know, there was a very bad period in the former Soviet Union when, after it broke down, there was a year when they didn't know how people are going to survive. Actually, the first winter was very, very difficult. There were no alternative plans, you know, structures to put in place. And they made it. I was fortunate. Global level, you know, with 6.3 million people, this could be extremely dangerous. So I think it's a good idea to have a vision of how a world could be organized in a different, more sustainable way.
As I said earlier, I mean, I think we're living in quite scary times, but you did end your talk last night in London on a very positive note, and you said it's a marvelous time to be alive.
It is. When before in the history of humanity had a group of people, one generation basically, have the opportunity to create something fundamentally new. Many times new things were created. They were much more local. They were happened to a single culture, a single continent, and so on. And they took usually several generations. Now the novelty is that the speed of change is increasing, is accelerating, and that is becoming global. So now at this time, within a matter of a decade or two, we could indeed create on a global level basically a new civilization. So I'm saying that it is an exciting time to be alive. If one just doesn't sleep through it, it will be very tragic if we live through these marvelous opportunities and then we would look back on it later and says, if only would have woken up and tried and became active at this time. So let's wake up. A lot of things can be done. The knowledge is there. The technology is there. Even the financial means, if you just reduce some arms expenditures, for example, would be there. No blockages, basically, other than the inertia of people just doing the same old thing, even though it doesn't make sense anymore.
Evan Laszlo, thank you very much.